the key is after 10, 15 years, like you said, you're not going to be back where you were, plus as if 10 years of aging had happened. You're just going to slowly continue to age from your new set
And
point.
then for the viewers out there, we can actually determine the direction of lift. And so why is this important?
The main consideration is who is doing your facelift and do they do a great facelift? So
this is why it's nice to get both, but some patients really don't need the brow. They may need mainly the eyelid lift.
The beauty scientists, Dr. Christy Hamilton and Dr. Roy Kim. Real beauty without the hype.
Hi, this is Dr. Roy Kim, as well as my counterpart and partner, Dr. Christy Hamilton, and you're going to be on The Beauty Scientist. So today we will be talking about facelift, neck lift, sort of an introduction to it, including what is a facelift, what is a neck lift, what are some of the procedures, some of the risks, and finally, what can enhance it. So Dr. Hamilton, what exactly is a facelift?
So facelift and neck lift, these are surgical procedures that we do. They are geared towards it's rejuvenating the face and neck. So this is the most powerful option we have in our armamentarium. So non-surgical or surgical, this is the pinnacle of facial rejuvenation. And I view the operation as addressing three components. So one is restoring or anti-gravity. So we want to restore where the tissues were originally positioned. So getting everything up. Number two is restoring lost volume. So we know our facial skeleton shrinks, our fat pads shrink. And then on top of it, our face and the skin and the tissues get lax or loose. And so it's almost like we have the balloon gets deflated and then the balloon is saggy on top of it. So we want to restore volume. And there's a couple ways to do that. But fat grafting or fat transfer is favored right now. And then secondly, we remove the extra skin once we've restored and lifted the structure. And some individuals will also include a chemical peel or laser resurfacing to a certain degree at the time of their facelift as well or afterwards.
That's a great answer. And then we'll be getting into the anatomy more of the face in just a second. So what is a neck lift as opposed to a facelift?
So this is a good question. So, you know, face clearly, you don't need to be in medicine to know this, but we consider this starts at the jawline and neck is everything beneath that and down. Dr. Kim, do you face only or neck only, or is this something you tend to combine and why?
Yeah, it's hard to do only face and it's hard to do only neck because the face, as a plastic surgeon, we're thinking of the face, but also just above the jawline. Well, most patients have a little loose jowl skin. They may need the muscles in their neck tightened. They need their neck skin tightened. That's impossible unless you go down towards the neck. The flip side is also true. We could do a neck lift that's very isolated and we can drape the skin behind the ear. Sometimes though, you have loose jowl skin, or when we tighten the skin behind the ear, you have excess skin that sort of pops up in front of your earlobe. Well, the only way to deal with that skin that pops up in front of the earlobe is to actually make an incision in front of the ear. And then by definition, that's a facelift. So I think that maybe very young patients in their 30s or 40s might get away with isolated procedures like only a face and only a neck, but the vast majority of patients do require both at the same time.
Right. And generally speaking, when people are coming in, they have a real reason to have surgery, although there is a trend to having a surgery younger. We'll talk about that too. But you can imagine you don't want to look like a bobblehead. So, it limits us. We can't create this really tight, really dramatic jawline if we're having significant sagging, deep folds, because we want the result to look harmonious. We want it to look natural, and people don't age in pieces.
Yes.
So we don't want to have your face look exactly the same. And then the face of a 50-year-old and the neck of a 30-year-old, that just doesn't make sense. So I agree. Most people end up having at least a component of both. And I think there's a lot of branding of these procedures with actual names, or people, I think oftentimes they like saying that they're having a mini lift, a mini facelift or a mini neck lift, because it makes it feel like it's not as big of an operation. But when I'm counseling patients, I remember in training seeing people, I was like, oh, we're going to see a mini facelift today. Curious about that. And then I realized, oh, that was that surgeon's, like, it was still the full facelift, but the patient was like, I'm having a mini facelift. So I think if you're going to go in for it, if you're going to have the scars, which should be beautiful at the end. But if you're going to go in and undergo the whole procedure, the recovery, then I think you ought to address everything because you're going to be making, you know, you're going to be entering the face and neck anyways. So Dr. Kim, if when we're looking at the anatomy and the structures of the face, what are you looking at when you're doing your facial analysis? What are you assessing and what are you mainly addressing in the face and neck lift?
If you're just looking at someone straight on, you're looking classically at the upper third, middle third, and lower third of the face. So you're concerned about brow position, whether the patient needs a forehead lift or not. You can keep on going down, so you can be concerned, does this patient need an eyelid lift or not? Do they need enhancement to the cheek to actually have it lifted or to go forward with just fat grafting to the area? And then for the lower third, I mean, we definitely have jowling, but what about the nasolabial fold, the marionette line, the lips, and then boom, you're at the mandible already. Finally, you're at the neck. So we are worried about loose skin or not, making it tight but not too tight. And muscle banding is very common here. We can eliminate that muscle banding, the platysma muscles, with a pretty short incision directly underneath the chin, but you may need it, you may not, and it just depends. And then when you're looking at the face, Dr. Hamilton, and the neck, I know that I just discussed anatomically looking at it from the front, but the deeper structures underneath the skin, what are you looking at as well as what are you looking to actually tighten to give the best long-lasting result?
That's a great question. So we are looking at obviously the quality of the skin. We see the platysma muscle that you mentioned before. So that's the part when you strain that sticks out and the bands that you're talking about. So we want to make sure that that's nice, smooth, and tight. Then, you know, so fat that's underneath the skin, we can address that with a minimally invasive procedure like cemental liposuction, but oftentimes there's fat that's deeper, that's below the platysma muscle. So we have the opportunity to address that when we do a neck lift because we're directly looking at it. And then some patients have, there's other structures. Some people, they have prominent muscles that are underneath this chin area here, prominent salivary glands called the submandibular glands. So for some patients, those are very prominent as well. And that can be because they're sagging and kind of herniating outward, or it can be just because they're big. So I don't think those should be removed or addressed in every single patient. You also don't want to make a neck that looks skeletonized. But for some patients, you're not going to be able to get as nice of a contour if you're not tightening the strength structures and also removing some of these bulky structures.
And to toot our own horn, we wrote an abstract on how to actually eliminate or diminish these salivary glands, the submandibular glands, without surgery.
Yes. And we looked at injecting Dysport, or you could use any neuromodulator like Botox. And what we found is that this is a very, very safe way to shrink the salivary glands without having to surgically remove them, because there can be complications associated with that procedure. It works really, really well. And interestingly enough, we see that after one or maybe two treatments that it doesn't seem to get big again, which is nice, but your salivary function still works. Although I had one patient that had a little bit of a dry mouth afterwards, but it was temporary.
That's great. Yes. So it works for those people out there. And then when you look at a patient for the upper third, like forehead or forehead and eyelid lift, how do you figure out like which patient needs a forehead lift versus which patient needs an eyelid lift versus a patient who needs both?
That's a great question. So I start with brow position first. That's going to tell me, because you can see if I push my eyebrow down, well, it looks like I need an eye lift there. Look at all that extra skin. But if I pull the brow up, and for women, we like the brow to be about a centimeter above the brow bone or the supraorbital rim. So you can feel that minimum half centimeter, ideally one. For men, we like the eyebrow to be on the brow bone. So it's different. You can see that looking at you. Yours looks like it's right on the brow bone.
Yes.
So that's something that can tell us if, you know, it's really eyelid surgery we're talking about, or if it's, we need to start with the brow lift. Now, after you get the brow in the appropriate position, if you still have excess eyelid skin, then that can be an indication to go ahead and do upper eyelid surgery. And lower eyelids, it's usually less about extra skin, although there's often some there too, and more about fat pads and bulges. And patients like to just have a nice smooth under eye area. So that's, you know, the quick version of what I'm looking for the upper third of the face.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. It totally makes sense. And this is why it's nice to get both, but some patients really don't need the brow. They may need mainly the eyelid lift.
Yeah. And some patients will say, hey, I understand what you're talking about, that the brow lift would help. I'm okay with having a little bit of a longer scar in the eyelid crease, and I'm going to go for that kind of simpler recovery. And that's fair too. I just think it's important to inform the patients, and then they can choose.
Yeah, totally agree.
Okay, let's talk about kinds of facelifts, because this is one of, you know, lots of the techniques that we do are kind of internal, like plastic surgeon to plastic surgeon. We talk about them so we can communicate about what we're doing when we're talking to colleagues. I think the SMAS facelift versus the deep plane, that's actually gotten popularized on social media, and patients actually come in knowing about this. They don't think they have necessarily a deep knowledge of it. Some do. What do you think about the different kinds of facelifts? Is one superior? What do you think?
I think, you know, as background, one thing we mentioned is the SMAS, S-M-A-S. So obviously we all have skin, and we're not tightening skin only. Yes, we're tightening the skin. We're trimming some skin. But if you just did a skin facelift, which is what they did in the 60s and earlier, results look great for about a year. It will fade. So then in the 70s, they discovered SMAS, superficial musculoapatorotic system, which essentially is the fascia of the facial structures. So if you tighten that stuff up, I mean, you get a much better result as well as a longer lasting result. So what Dr. Hamilton is describing, and what we'll go into detail, of course, is, okay, we can identify this mass. We need to remove some of it, slash tighten it, slash suture it onto itself, slash go under it and tighten it some more. What's the best way to do it? And this is where deep plane comes into social media knowledge, because deep plane is from, honestly, like the late 80s, 90s, and then it fell out of favor, and now it's coming back into favor. And really all deep plane means is you're going underneath the SMAS in an area that's maybe a little more medial. In other words, going towards that direction than what a lot of people do. And depending on how it's accessed and how it's tightened, you can start arguing about whether it's true deep plane or not.
So there you have it. So there's a lot of lingo, and these things tend to be very, very circular. We see that a lot. We see it with like threads, in this case, facelifting. So a lot of these concepts, you know, human facial anatomy hasn't changed, right? Decade to decade. So sometimes it's almost like we're, as a community, like rediscovering things or different techniques. So if you go back far enough, it's worth taking a look, because you'll find that some of our predecessors may have already answered these questions for us. So there have been studies performed. Dr. Rourke likes to cite this one, where they look at both techniques, and you can have great long-lasting outcomes with both. The main consideration is who is doing your facelift, and do they do a great facelift? So I would say mainly surgeon dependent rather than technique dependent. I think jury's still out on what the ultimate best technique is. So we'll see. We'll see if we go full circle again.
Yes. And then for the viewers out there, we can actually determine the direction of lift. And so why is this important? We can actually, yes, we want to go up, but if you go 100% vertical, it looks a little odd. We want to tighten the skin to the side. But again, if you go 100% horizontal, you have that beautiful windswept tunnel look, which nobody wants. It has to be at an angled vector, you know, at an angle, not 100% up, not 100% sideways. What's that angle? As Dr. Rourke always says, the anatomy is always the same. Every patient's different. So what's best for you? I can't tell you what the angle is, because I have to do it in the operating room and figure out the best angle for you to tighten up the SMAS underneath the skin so that you look rejuvenated, but you don't look odd. Do you have any opinions as to like the best angle or the best way to do it or anything like that?
Well, I agree. I was like, even when you look at people's faces, like you'll see like one side is different than the other. So it's not uncommon to even have slightly different vectors, usually not wildly different vectors, but slightly different vectors on either side of the face, because we all have a shorter, wider side and a taller, thinner side. And if you take a true front-facing image and cut that picture in half and then transpose it, and you can see what you look like with two left sides of your face kind of flipped and two right sides of your face flipped, and you'll see you look like two completely different people. So that's a really good point. So I think we're tailoring it, and I'm looking at it in real time in the operating room and also following the marks that I make on the patient's face before I start to try to create as much symmetry as we possibly can. What are the main risks of facelift and neck lift?
Yeah, I think the biggest things we're concerned about are bleeding and the nerve. So interestingly, I don't think infection is a big concern because the bleeding's so good. If there's good blood flow, there's less risk of infection. Well, the problem is the face has such awesome blood flow that this is what we worry about. We want to control your blood pressure, make sure you're not on any blood thinners, make sure as surgeons, when we're operating, everything is dried up. There's no bleeding at all before closing it. And that way you don't have a hematoma after surgery. The other big risk, of course, is that we have the facial nerve, the nerve that gives us animation or emotions. It's sort of rare to very difficult to actually ding the actual facial nerve. It's more a concern of dinging or potentially damaging branches of the facial nerve, which is why knowledge of anatomy is so important. And avoiding the branches or where they are is the best way to prevent this from happening.
Yes. So you can have weakness afterwards. It's rare to have like complete paralysis after, but sometimes people feel like their mouth feels a little bit funny afterwards, or they're smiling a little bit broader on one side versus the other. And most of the time it's just that the nerve maybe has been like stretched or something like that. And so it just needs a little bit of time to come back to life, but rarely you can have paralysis. And that of course is a major complication and a little bit higher risk with the deep laying because you're closer to that nerve. So you need to really be, you can absolutely do the surgery safely. You can do both styles safely, but you need to know your anatomy. You need to know where you are. So very common question. We get asked, I think, about every surgery we do, but how long does a good facelift last?
I think weirdly enough, we're finding out that it depends on your body, how much you take care of your skin and how much you take care of yourself. But I think it should last about 10 to 15 years. And this also assumes that you don't gain 75 pounds and lose 75 pounds. You actually protect your skin from the sun. You're not decided to smoke 2 packs a day after surgery of cigarettes or whatever. Assuming you do all the good things, it will last a pretty long time. It's actually one of the more cost-effective procedures, amazingly enough, in aesthetic surgery. So do you have any hints for patients on how to maintain their facelift?
Yeah, so I completely agree. So beyond the genetic results or the genetic component, just like your own like tissue qualities, which if you're blessed to have that, that's great. I completely agree with lifestyle. So we know high sugar consumption is terrible for skin. Drinking is terrible for your skin. Exercise is great for your skin and healthy living. So eating a rich, balanced diet, wearing sunscreen every day, not going out too much in the sun, all those things are going to help. And then I would be doing procedures like we talked about. There's so many things that you can do afterwards to enhance and maintain your surgical results. So whether that's resurfacing later, lasers, microneedling, doing like chemical peels to get rid of the sun damage, Botox. And then, you know, as volume loss continues, conservative filler injections, those are all great ways to keep your face looking youthful and balanced, because it's not that aging won't continue, right? We always say we're resetting the clock with your facelift or your breast lift or whatever it may be, but time will march on. The key is after 10, 15 years, like you said, you're not going to be back where you were plus as if 10 years of aging had happened. You're just going to slowly continue to age from your new set point.
Yeah. One of the things we should talk about is the increasing use or pretty much all the time of fat. So fat grafting to the face is a newer concept, let's say past 5 or 10 years. But now I'm doing it all the time. I know you are as well. Any hints on where to place the fat or how the fat is prepared or all that good stuff when you're doing facial and neck rejuvenation?
I like to take the fat from the inner thigh. It's got a really high stem cell concentration. Other areas like the lower abdomen, also one of the higher adipose stem cell concentrations on the body. I think the inner thigh fat is kind of mimics like facial fat in a lot of ways. It's soft and malleable and not doesn't have a lot of fibrous tissue. So I like it there. And then where I graft is very dependent on, again, the face. So I like to see nice, full, but not overly full cheeks. I'll do the entire jawline. If the patient has a smaller chin, I'll put it there. Temples are a big area. That's one of those places that patients don't necessarily notice by themselves. But if you have a little bit of a peanut shape and volume loss there, that's one of those areas that makes you look older, even though you may not realize it. If you have volume loss around the eyes, I'll put a little bit in the tear trough, even in the eye socket area, nasolabial folds. I put it basically everywhere across the face except for the lips.
Yeah.
That I reserve lip fillers for if patients want fuller lips or maybe a lip lift if it's appropriate. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So essentially, you're giving it the same place as I'm giving it, everywhere in the face, because it actually, yes, it gives you volume, but stem cells, just in case of for those of you out there, stem cells turn into other types of cells. So if you put stem cells into an area where there's usually fat, the stem cells should turn into more youthful fat cells. And it seems to not just give volume, it actually rejuvenates the skin. It actually makes your skin glow and look better after fat grafting.
And that's what we want, right? Because that's another component of this that we talk about is, okay, so the facelift is going to restore like the structural component of the face. We want it to look right, but we also want everything to look very harmonious, right? So we want the quality of the skin also to match the structure. If you have horribly sun damaged skin from a lifetime of sun worshiping, and then you have now this like nice taut jawline, that doesn't necessarily make sense either. So it's nice to have the fat grafting to help with the quality of the skin. And then also for patients like that, not on the sides of the face, but certainly centrally and in the forehead, I'll do laser resurfacing at the same time.
Yeah. And the final touch, of course, is we can tighten skin. We can do a lot of things to the structures underneath the face, but we actually, sadly, cannot improve skin quality of the face after we're done with all this stuff. So I know that I use chemical peels. I have used laser. What do you like to do after the final end of the procedure, or maybe just focus on surgery and then do facial resurfacing in the future, in the near future?
I love to do central laser resurfacing. So eyelids, nose, central face, I kind of feather it out to the sides. I don't go aggressively on the sides. I'll do the forehead aggressively, especially if we're not doing a lift at the same time. And so I think that's a great opportunity. You're going to be at home recovering from this anyway. So great time to do the laser as well. And if patients choose not to, or even if they do it during surgery, then we can do a more aggressive one 3 months later, or when the patient's ready, include the entire face and the sides and the neck as well. And I think that is a beautiful way, like cherry on top, to complete your facial rejuvenation.
Yeah. And for the viewers and listeners out there, the reason why we're not giving it all the way to the skin edge or to the sides is because we're concerned about blood flow and healing after surgery. So I don't think anybody really does, hey, let's blast it with the maximum amount of power right at the skin edge to rejuvenate the skin. We don't do that because we're worried about blood flow and healing.
Right. And you have to think about if you're lifting up that area, you're cutting underneath it, then you're going to blast it from the outer surface. And the skin, for some patients, really, really thin. So you have to know your patient, know what also like their skin type and quality, and then adjust their laser treatments and where you're treating, whether it's a laser or a chemical peel.
Yeah, good point. And this is what we're concerned about with all of our patients.
Yes. Always.
Yes.
Blood supply.
Well, I don't have any other topics or questions. Do you have any other topics you want to bring up with the facelift, neck lift?
No, I think it's a very powerful operation. It is the epitome of facial rejuvenation. The final comment I would say is that patients are starting to do these surgeries a little bit younger. I think we'll see more of that, especially with the weight loss that we're seeing secondary to Ozempic and Mounjaro and all these other drugs. So we're seeing younger people that have lost a lot of weight and then now have significant laxity in their face. Same concept, you know, the balloon has popped. And so you can't exercise skin away. So I think we'll be doing more and more of that. And then I think there's also a trend towards just earlier intervention, even if you're not a massive weight loss patient, just so that you're not unveiling this dramatic change. You're just looking like those Hollywood stars that just seem to stay the same always. And in fact, kind of get better.
Yes.
Aging like a fine wine.
And then we all know, at least you and I know, that if you get a smaller procedure, you're going to have a less noticeable difference, which is what a lot of people want, a lot faster recovery, actually probably a little less pain. If you're older and you need a much bigger procedure, well, it's going to take longer. You're going to have more swelling, more potential bruising, and it will just be a lot more noticeable in a good way, but it will definitely be more noticeable to your family and friends.
Yeah, so there'll be no hiding it then.
Right.
Something clearly happened.
Well, as always, a great topic, a fun-filled discussion. And thanks so much for joining me, Dr. Hamilton, for the Beauty Scientist. And as always, for all the viewers and listeners out there, if you have any questions, let us know. And definitely stay beautiful.
Stay beautiful.
Thank you for joining us on The Beauty Scientist. Be sure to visit thebeautyscientist.com and learn more about modern beauty and connect with Dr. Hamilton and Dr. Kim.